then the bottom about in what manner princes should keep their faith. Is that right? So that's the one thing you haven't talked about. Okay, so we're not going to do the discourses in here. You are welcome to read them. I think I had mentioned to you that in Machiavelli's studies, there's always this division of, well, how could The Prince of 1513 be written by the same guy who wrote Discourses on Livy, which was published on Machiavelli's death? So how could you, they're so different one from another. We're not going to go over the discourses. I do want you to know at least that, though, about them, that the discourses are regarded as something very, very good, whereas The Prince is regarded as pretty bad. And most people, even if, yeah, and there is an interpretation, there's a strong school of thought, including one that is mostly taught in politics here at this school, which is a completely legitimate way of arguing. But there's an argument that The Prince was meant to be satire. If that's true, and it may have been, but if that's true, it has never been taken that way. It's been used as the handbook for all tyrants everywhere since he wrote it. So we can't necessarily blame an author for his work, but we can judge someone by the fruits of their work. And I think we see what that's done. And everybody from, you know, Hitler to Stalin, everybody, Pol Pot, it doesn't matter. They've all referred to Machiavelli and seen that as the handbook of how to rule. So one of the great questions we have, as I hope you understood when you're reading The Prince, is Machiavelli does make a very realistic point. And that point is you always have to have the consent of the governed in your government. Now, that sounds crazy to us because as good Americans, we say, well, it's we the people. And we mean by that, well, that's good. Right? That's really good that we the people get to choose. What Machiavelli says, and I think he's right about this, for better or worse, is even tyrannies have to be governed by the consent of the people, meaning they're not revolting. So it's maybe rather than saying consent, because it sounds so positive, maybe we could say that tyrants can only exist as long as the people tolerate them. And once they stop tolerating them, then the tyrants have to give up. Does that make sense for everyone? I think that's probably an important way to think of how people rule. So this is, and you guys were not born yet, but I remember it because I was a senior in college as this happened. Now, I very clearly remember the wall coming down in Berlin. You know, we were all rather shocked that happened. I think only Ronald Reagan and John Paul II weren't shocked. Everybody else in the world was shocked. They understood it was going to happen, and maybe Solzhenitsyn too. But I think it was a huge, huge change, and yet not a single shot was fired when the wall came down. It was an utterly 100% peaceful protest, so much so that when people went to Honecker, his house, at the fall of the wall and wanted to kill him because he'd been the evil dictator, a very, very, very good Lutheran minister who had been personally tortured by Honecker, stood in front of him and told the people, we will not treat this man as anything other than a person fallen in the image of Christ. And the mob quieted, all because of this extremely brave Lutheran pastor. So this is proof, or at least it's an indication, that in history, you still have to have some consent or at least toleration for evil. Or not evil, to be like with that Lutheran pastor, really shunning, or shaming, I should say, properly shaming the mob. Okay, so let's look at that. I think this is probably the perfect summation of Machiavelli if we look on 556. So if someone would like to read, we'll just start right at the bottom there. It is not necessary, however. So let's see. Charles, have you read in a while?
No.
You'd love to, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Thank you.
Where exactly?
Right at the bottom of 556. Right, so it is not necessary.
Okay. It is not necessary, however, for a prince to possess all the above-mentioned qualities, but it is essential that he should at least seem to have them. I will even venture to say that to have and to practice them constantly is pernicious.
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 Right, evil.
But to seem to have them is useful. For instance, a prince should seem to be merciful, faithful, humane, religious, and upright, and should even be so in reality. But he should have his mind so trained that when occasion requires it, he may know how to change to the opposite. And it must be understood that a prince, and especially one who has but recently acquired his state, cannot perform all those things which cause men to be esteemed as good, he being often obliged for the sake of maintaining his state to act contrary to human charity and religion. And therefore, is it necessary that he should have a versatile mind, capable of changing readily according as the winds and changes for fortune bid him, and, as has been said above, not to swerve from the good if possible, but to know how to resort to evil if necessity demands it. A prince then should be very careful never to allow anything to escape his lips that does not abound in the above-named five qualities, so that to see and to hear him he may seem all charity, integrity, and humanity, all uprightness, and all piety. And more than all else is it necessary for a prince to seem to possess the last quality, for mankind in general judge more by what they see and hear than by what they feel, everyone being capable of the former, but few of the latter. Everybody sees what you seem to be, but few really feel what you are. And these few dare not oppose the opinion of the many, who are protected by the majesty of the state. For the actions of all men, and especially those of princes, are judged by the result, where there is no other judge to whom to appeal. A prince then should look mainly to the successful maintenance of his state. The means which he employs for this will always be accounted honorable, and will be praised by everybody. For the common people are always taken by appearances and by results, and it is the vulgar mass that constitutes the world. But if very few have rank and station, whilst the many have nothing to sustain them. A certain prince of our time, whom it is well not to name, never preached anything but peace and good faith. But if he had always observed either the one or the other, it would, in most instances, have cost him his reputation or his state.
Okay, well done, Charles, thank you. So I want you all, you should underline, or at least mark, line 37 on page 556, 35 and 37, where we have these five qualities: mercy, faith, humanity, religion, and being morally upright. That those are the qualities that everyone should act upon as a ruler. But notice why you do that. You do it for one reason only, because that's what the people expect of you. If you actually act on it at all times, you're an absolute fool, to the point where not only as a leader are you a fool, but where Machiavelli says, it's pernicious. In other words, if a leader actually behaved in a virtuous manner because the leader believed in virtue, he's evil. It's an inversion of good and evil. And so if you are in charge of a state, you must do whatever the people think is right by appearance, but not in reality. Behind the scenes, you do whatever is possible. So what we find here, and I hope this is clear what Machiavelli's doing, he is absolutely, and we're entering, and I'm not gonna break into a Disney song here, but we are truly entering into a whole new world with this, because we have now completely inverted the Socratic ethic. The Socratic ethic, never do harm, no matter the reason, ever, under any circumstance, can you do harm. And yet, he's inverted that completely. So imagine, you know, doctors, of course they don't do this now, they stopped this a few years ago, but when they take the Hippocratic Oath, never to do harm, Machiavelli is saying, if a president or a ruler or a prince ever did that, they are actually being evil. Evil is not being evil, right? That's crazy for him in the way that he's putting it, but this is a complete inversion. So what we find, and why this new world suddenly appears, is that we find the Socratic understanding of love, the giving of oneself, has now, in the modern world, what makes Machiavelli so significant, has changed to power. So think about even the arguments, and please know I'm not being political here, but when you had people arguing in favor of Hillary Clinton, you had one side saying, it'll be so great to have a woman, this is absolutely necessary. You had another side saying, yeah, sure, it's great to have a woman, just not this woman, because she's not virtuous. Why would you want your first woman president to be a scandalous person? That goes against it. And that was a perfect summation during that week of power versus love and what matters here. So think about, you know, when you study literature quite often, especially in, say, and I'm very interested in this for lots of reasons, but when you study female characters in novels, we're almost always more interested in female characters who use power rather than those who rely on virtue. Now, that's true for male characters as well, but it's certainly true in literature. And that's a very modern notion. If you think about how could you ever write a power story about Perpetua? It's not possible. She doesn't want power. She throws it in the face of those who hold it. How about Mary, Jesus's mother? Could you ever write a story about the first feminist, Mary? It makes no sense. Even Antigone is not a feminist in the modern sense because she is concerned with challenging power rather than embracing power. And that's a theme. It's a deep, deep theme in the Western tradition. Forget the women-men argument for a moment. That's not, of course, where I'm going with this. But Machiavelli argues that we must engage power and that is a good for the ruler, even if that is used in a duplicitous or evil fashion. So it no longer matters if you do harm. If you do harm for the right reasons, that is the security and stability of your people, then it's okay. Is that everybody clear on that? So this is why one reason we do this in this class, but think about, and you guys all did so well on this. I mean, your tests were excellent. But on your question on Aquinas, think about Aquinas's idea of kingship. Yeah, if we put it next to Machiavelli, if we put the two books next to each other, if we ripped out the pages in here, don't do that, but if we ripped out the pages in between on kingship and the prince, this thing would catch on fire, right? I mean, they can't be next to each other. They're so opposite. And Aquinas, of course, is the end of what I would say was the most enlightened period of Western civilization. Machiavelli is the beginning of a dark age. Now, I realize I'm in no way sounding like modern historians. I sound like an idiot saying that. But I do think it's a point that's well worth thinking about, that Machiavelli enters us into this whole new way of thinking. And it's always been there. Everybody's understood it. We've known it since Adam and Eve. But we've always tried to fight it. Now it's not just, well, hey, it's natural, it's good, right? It's become something else. And we have some politicians who don't do this. George Washington's a Thomist, whether he read Aquinas or not. Every act he ever performed in his presidency as general, no matter his flaws, is a fallen man like all of us, but he was the living embodiment of the Thomistic king. He did everything exactly the way a good leader does. We've had other leaders, like Richard Nixon, who will engage in the Machiavellian way no matter what, and will lie openly to the American people. So, I mean, we see this, and frankly, we've only had about three presidents who've behaved, at least in my mind, who've behaved in a Thomistic proper fashion. The vast majority of our presidents have been scum. They've acted like Machiavellians. And that, even in a republic, even in a good country, we're a good country, generally, we've behaved poorly at times, and that's a very difficult thing. So, again, Machiavelli doesn't introduce evil. It's always been there. But he begins to argue that it's a good thing to have because it keeps stability. So, Jordan and then Mary Kate.
Which three presidents?
Jordan. Washington, for sure. I think Lincoln, though there'd be huge disagreement on that. And I think Reagan. I think we're the three greatest. I think they're the only three people we've ever had in the White House who actually used the office with wisdom, for that, whatever that's worth. I mean, here, I'm. Who am I to speak? I've never been in politics or power, but just from my reading, I think they're the three. I think there are some good people. But I don't think, absolutely. But think about this in leadership. There are three qualities that a truly good leader has: charisma, intelligence, and ability to actually make real their ideas. Thomas Jefferson's probably the smartest president we've ever had, maybe the smartest person ever born on American soil. He's a terrible president. Right? And I think Bill Clinton, brilliant. Absolutely. Nixon's brilliant. Nixon may be the single smartest person in the 20th century in terms of IQ in the presidency. That doesn't translate necessarily into good leadership. So that's all I'm saying. I think Jimmy Carter's a good man. He was a terrible president. Yeah. So I think it's very rare to find somebody who is both powerful but virtuous at the same time. So, but you guys know, this is my opinion, right? I mean, it's purely my opinion. So you feel free in every way to disagree, but that would be so. Yeah, Mary Kate.
That was my question.
Oh, God, I shouldn't have said it. I do believe it, but I'm not sure how relevant it is. Well, yeah, I guess it is. It's our common frame of reference. I won't feel too guilty about that. Okay, any other thoughts on this? We're going to jump into something else in a moment, but I want to read to you for a bit from, I had told you about this play, that at least for me defines what Machiavelli is. So whether we want to look at him as the author of The Prince or the author of The Discourses, this play, I think, reveals almost everything about who this man really was. And I think that's generally true in literature, that we see a real face come out, even if we have to do some digging and interpreting. But this play called Mandragola is, and I mentioned it to you before, at least want you to know the name and the background of the story. You don't need to know all the characters. It reads like a Shakespearean play if Shakespeare were evil. Right? So it has a very, and you can tell they're of the same century, even though Shakespeare is born much later. I should say of the same era, not the same century, but they're born of the same era. And Shakespeare, though, is very different. He may introduce bad characters, but of course we always know they're bad. And if you want to read any of Shakespeare's plays that almost certainly were a challenge to Machiavelli, we don't have absolute proof of this, but it seems pretty clear. The Tempest and Measure for Measure would be the ones that really challenge this play in particular. And a lot, there's some, obviously you've got some of the world's greatest Shakespeare scholars on this campus, so you should turn to them far more than me. I mean, you're playing at the margins at best when dealing with this. But I'm just gonna read to you one passage from Mandragola. So Mandragola is exactly what it sounds like. If we made it English, it would be mandrake, meaning the root of the dragon. And in the medieval period and early medieval period, now this is not true in China, right? In China, you can have good dragons. In Western European literature, there is never a good dragon until the 20th century. So dragons always, without question, for all of pagan as well as Christian society, are always symbolic of the devil in some way. So I realize, that's changed a lot in modern. I think Tolkien was probably the last to give us the evil dragon. No, I guess Lewis would have, right? In the one story where Eustace becomes the dragon. That's a pretty good. But after that, dragons become kind of good in Western literature. Whether that should be the case or not might be debatable. But certainly at this time period, to invoke a dragon is basically a nice way of invoking Satan. And so the mandrake root, which is a poisonous root, the mandrake root was known as, and I hope you guys all know this, and I don't mean to be too PG-13 here, but birth control has been around forever. So the time periods in American history where women don't use it, Planned Parenthood will argue that's because they were ignorant. They were not ignorant. People have known about abortion and abortion techniques forever. It's one of the first things we find in human history. People trying to figure out how this might be aborted or not. It's, for better or worse, it's a part of human history. But the other thing that you have to know, so we've got birth control. But the other thing is, so I'm sorry, I was mixing birth control and abortion, but there's always been birth control. There's also always been abortifacients, right, always in history. And one of the ways in the medieval period that you could abort a baby was to drink the mandrake root. That you also put your own life in very serious danger, but that was one way of doing it. So in a sense, calling this Mandragola, this play, is basically Machiavelli saying, hey, let's talk about Satan, and let's talk about abortion, and it's pretty blatant. So this, rather than being called Mandragola, it could be how Satan leads to abortion, but that might be good, right? That's kind of what the subtitle would be if that's the case. So here's what happens. There are some funny moments in it. I will not deny that. There's some, Machiavelli could be quite humorous, but it's a really wicked humor. So the whole point of the play is to understand exactly what he said in that last part that Charles very nicely read. How do we pretend we're good when in fact we're not good at all? And we don't want to be good. We just have to pretend we're good. So it's appearance. Everything is appearance. Remember, we can go back to Aristotle. The accidents of a thing are always the expression of the essence of a thing. But the essence is what matters. Now Machiavelli is saying, well, the accidents, the appearance, only matters because it's what other people see. Doesn't matter what's going on inside. So you can do all kinds of things. So what happens in this play, and it's very complicated actually, even though it's really short, you could read it in an hour at most. It's very disturbing, but you could read it in an hour. What you find is you've got, supposedly, a man who's trying to show the church as being a fraud. Now, they're not wrong about this, and this is a name I want you all to know, and we'll get more into him, especially next week. But there are really bad popes. All right? That, it doesn't matter if you're Catholic or not. There have been truly evil popes. And I realize the church, the Catholic Church, teaches that popes are generally, well, it says actually they're not. But there have been really, and I say that as a Catholic, you know, may God forgive me, but there have been utterly evil popes. And one of them, I'm not sure if there was a more evil one, we just don't have the records for him. But Alexander VI was the worst pope in history. This is a guy who is pope when Machiavelli's writing. So when Machiavelli talks about power, he actually likes this pope. He thinks what the pope is doing is good. But so here's what this pope does, and it's, in a sense, it's so evil, it's funny. But he has lots and lots and lots of kids. They're all, of course, bastards, because he's not supposed to be having kids. And often he just abuses the kids to no end when they show up. But more importantly, his kind of great way of dealing with his enemies is he invites them for dinner, and then he poisons them. So he did this repeatedly, where he would just serve wine that was poisoned, and of course the guy dies, and it's the Pope, so you're not gonna look too closely into the murder, even though there's like 50 guys in a row who died 50 nights in a row. But everybody knows how bad he is. So one of the great, and I think this is just justice, but one night as he's trying to poison somebody, he confuses the glasses and he drinks his own poison, the one he was supposed to give to the other guy, and he dies. Now, this tells you something. This is a time period where the Catholic Church is the only church, so what alternative are you going to have? But the people of Rome celebrated for 3 weeks straight the death of the Antichrist when he died. Now, that tells you something, right? So, again, I apologize. I realize for those of you who are Catholic, this is, and for those of you who are not Catholic, you're thinking, I knew those guys were bad. But anyway, it's he was bad, right? As Russell Kirk, who was himself a convert to Catholicism and rather devout, as he said, Alexander VI was a monster of avarice and appetite. It's all he was. He was a demon in human form, basically. So I bring that up because it's hard to understand. Now, Machiavelli likes that guy. Now, that tells you something, too. It's like, yeah, Alexander's kind of our model. All right, so in this play, you have someone who's trying to show that at essence, the church is purely a facade. So note this is before the Reformation. So Reformation hasn't happened yet when he's writing this play. We're a day away from it, basically, but it hasn't happened yet. So we're at the end of that period, and he wants to show that the church is all appearance, and it always looks good. But then at its heart, its soul, it's utterly corrupt. So the way Machiavelli portrays this is he convinces a priest, supposedly a good priest, that he should get this abortifacient, this mandragora, into a nunnery so that a young woman who's gotten pregnant in a scant, of course she's a nun, it's totally scandalous, by a very elite person in town, that she will abort the baby. And if she aborts the baby, then this original donor will give tons and tons of money to the priest who has done all of this. So you'll just listen to this. Does that make sense? Okay, now, you have to know, this is part of the play, there is no such nun who's pregnant. It's all a ruse. It's all to see if the priest will agree to do it. And he does. But there's never actually, I mean, I'm sure there were pregnant nuns, but that's not in the story. There's no such character. It's all a lie. So it's not actually going to happen. But the priest doesn't know that. The priest believes very strongly that this happened. So we have two figures who show up and talk to the priest. So I'll try and keep these straight. So I'm just going to tell you, you guys don't even have to know if you don't want. But so the rich guy who wants to show what the church is and how bad they are, is a guy named Ligurgio. Now, I don't know if that means much to you, but liturgy, right? So, and the priest is Timoteo, which is basically Timaeus mixed with God. So there's a Platonic Christian element in that. So what will happen? Okay, Ligurgio. I don't know if you know Camillo Claluffi, nephew of the the senior, as translated, Timoteo the priest. Yes, I know him, Ligurgio. Well, a year ago, this man went to France on some business of his, and not having a wife, for she had died, he left his one marriageable daughter in the care of a convent, the name of which I don't have to tell you, Timoteo the priest. Oh, well, what followed, Ligurgio? It followed that either through the carelessness of the nuns or the brainlessness of this girl, she found herself pregnant. So that if the situation's not repaired with prudence, then my friend, as well as the nuns and the girl and the house of my friend, will be disgraced. And of course, we would see that this is a great shame. For if we can figure out how not to disclose this information to the world, I would give you 300 ducats. That's a lot of money. So I'd give you 300 ducats, and believe me, when I give it to you, it would all be for the love of God. Oh, well, what do you think? It could go through your hands, and only you, but you and the abbess can fix this, the priest. How? Ligurgio. By persuading the abbess, the head of the nun, the mother superior, to give this girl the mandragula root to make her miscarry her baby. Timoteo. Well, that sounds possible. Ligurgio, now keep in mind, in doing this, Father, how many goods will result from it? You will maintain the honor of the nuns, of that girl, of all of her relatives. You will restore a daughter to her father and her father's house. You will satisfy so many people and so many relatives, and you could do as much charity as you want with the money that I give you. Imagine how many poor you could feed with the 300 ducats. And what happens? Who loses? Only offense will be given to a piece of unborn flesh, one without any sense, which could be dispersed in 1,000 different ways. And I believe that the good is that which does good for the most rather than to the one, and by which the most are contented. Father Timoteo, so be it in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. I will do what you want, and may everything be done for God and his love. Tell me the convent, give me the potion, and if you like, the money, with which I will begin to do some good for the poor. Ligurgio, now I understand. You truly are the man of religion that I believed you were. Take this money, the convent is, but wait, there's a woman in the church who's beckoning me. I'll be right back. Now don't leave. I would like to go say a couple words to that beautiful woman. That's the center of the play. So does this make sense for everyone? What Machiavelli's doing. Imagine 300 gold pieces, and of course 30 pieces of silver, right? But 300 gold pieces, think how many poor people you could save, and all that dies is an insensate piece of flesh. That's it. Well, that's amazing. And of course, this is all, Machiavelli thinks this is a hoot. This is not meant to be a morality play where we all think, oh gosh, you know, what terrible stuff. We're supposed to laugh at this priest and say, yeah, that's what the church is. It's just falsehood. So that's why I stress, and I'm obviously not a fan of Machiavelli, but I think it's really important that we understand there's a lot going on here. It's not just the prince and the discourses, but it's also indicative of the time. And this is kind of a chicken and egg argument. You know, which comes first, Machiavelli or modernity? You know, which is it? And it's hard to say. It's very hard to say. But I think that Machiavelli really does at least begin the end of the Western project of what we would call liberalism in the best sense. That is, liberating us from the things of this earth and being beholden to all good women and men from the beginning to the end. We're now becoming very rooted in time and place. And the realism that's there is a kind of realism that says, look, this is just the world that sucks. You might as well kill as many people as you need if you can get something good to happen afterwards. And we all make this calculus. I don't mean us in this room, but you know, the calculus of how many Jews could we gas in Auschwitz is obviously an utterly evil calculus at every level. But we as Americans, we've made similar decisions. How many of these American Indians are we willing to kill or remove so that people we like can have their property? How many Japanese civilians are we willing to nuke so that a million men don't have to go on shore? We make these calculations all the time. And it doesn't matter who's president. It's not left, it's not right, it's not Republican, it's not Democrat. It's the modern world. So the modern world is willing to make these statements. Whereas before, you know, evil is always there. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to suggest there are times where evil doesn't exist. Of course it always exists. But the question that we and every one of us in this room, I don't care if it's you as friend or student or father or mother, aunt, priest, nun, rabbi, whatever you are, we all every day have to make decisions. Do we do this because it's the right thing or because it's the expedient thing? That's the same question Socrates asked. It's the same question Machiavelli asked, but they had radically different answers. And you know, I have my preference, not that I always live up to it. In fact, I fail quite often, probably far more often than a person who studies this stuff should. But it's just something that's always there. These are not just historical questions. These are human questions, and they will rule everything you do, every moment of your life. And those are just decisions we have to make. What do we do? What do we don't? So I would ask you, though, to at least keep this in mind, and I realize I'm moralizing a little bit here, maybe more than a little bit, but you know, when you cast a ballot, when you make a statement, you are truly making a moral decision at every point. When you vote for this person, even if it's a lesser evil than the other person, you are making a moral calculus. And we all do that at all times, and we have to be very careful. Even times in the lunchroom, you're making decisions. You know, do I want to be by myself right now, which you have to be sometimes, or do I want to help Scott, who's really having some problems? You know, maybe we need to deal with that at the moment, even if that means I don't get to study for the quiz for next hour. Those are the kinds of things. They're not at the level of how many Jews are we going to gas, obviously, but they're still moral questions that we have to ask. So Machiavelli is important historically, but he's also important because he's getting to fundamental questions of human nature. I hate his answers, but we can't deny his questions. They're there, and they become very real in his time and place. Scott's not having problems from what I know of, by the way.
In a system of the Socratic ethic where you do what's right no matter the cost, what would be the rationale or the calculus that would be made between two wrong options? Like at the end of World War II,
sure,
every option that we could have taken, people would have died. Was there some kind of different calculus that they had?
Yeah. So let's put it this way, and this is a great question, Scott. Never, ever, ever, ever is it possible to have easy answers to these things. If we had easy answers to those things, they're probably not serious questions in the first place. So we always know what's absolutely evil, and we always know what's absolutely good. Doing the absolutely good thing is not always possible in this world, right? I mean, it would be great if it were, but there are times we have to do things that aren't necessarily the best. So, yeah, if someone breaks into your home and threatens your kid, yeah, I would argue pretty forcefully, you have the right, if not the duty, to put that person down. That's still not great. wouldn't it be better if you could restrain that person? But there are times, you know, you've got to quickly make a decision. Does that make sense? I'm not advocating necessarily one thing or another. But so in that case, you have to say, look, what do we do? But I think at a lot of times, like World War II, here's the question. So what do we know? We know that the Japanese have done this. I could list a million crimes the Japanese committed. You know, if you were a POW in World War II, you pray to God it's the Italians who take you first. They treat you like you're their best friends in a POW camp, basically. The Germans, believe it or not, treat you really, really well, too. That's amazing. You get sick, they take care of you. You're hungry, they feed you. They give you room to walk around if they have it. Germans, the Nazis, of all people, treated our POWs really well. Japanese, chance of you surviving a Japanese internment camp? Almost zero. Yeah, they do everything from insert glass into parts of your body and break it, shatter it, to every torture imaginable. It's just your chance of surviving a Japanese prison camp are about nothing. So I don't want to suggest they were good, right? And of course, when they took over China, yeah, if you're a Chinese woman and you're not raped, you are the person who just got away from everything. Yeah, it's like 99% of women in Nanking are going to be raped and murdered, right? So I'm not suggesting the Japanese are good in that place. But that doesn't mean we have the right to hit a civilian city. That's the point. So in just law, just rules of war, it's perfectly fine to hit the Japanese government and to hit Japanese soldiers anywhere. But to hit two civilian cities, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, that becomes a very different thing. So Hiroshima, there's no industry to speak of. It's a city of arts. Hiroshima is a civilian city. Yeah, you're not wiping out war industry in Hiroshima. Yeah, it's not there. Nagasaki, and I don't mean to privilege anybody, but Nagasaki was the one city under martial law in Japan because it was pro-US. Why? It had been Christianized by the Jesuits, and it was the most Christian city in all of Asia. It was almost 50% Christian. Now, okay, let's think about that. If you really want to hit somebody and hit them hard, do you wipe out the one city that's the Japanese have to spend tons of money with soldiers everywhere guarding the population because the population's pro-US? It's a little weird, right? I mean, so my point is, when you start hitting civilians, man, you're getting into really, really serious questions. And I'm not saying, you know, there are times a bomb goes the wrong way. There are casualties that are gonna happen, and that's inevitable. But when you target a hospital or you target a civilian city, that you're getting into really gray areas. So, and I will put it, you guys do not have to agree with me, and I'd be shocked if any one of you do. So don't feel like you have to agree with me. But if we had lost a million men, a million American men invading the Japanese island, that's our choice. You know, if they had fought soldiers, and I'm sorry that would have happened, but I think that's better than killing one woman or one child who's a civilian. I realize that may sound absurd to you, and I've been attacked for this much of my adult life, I understand. I'm weird on it, but I just think it's a major question we have to ask. I'm sorry to get into this too personally, but I ever tell you guys about my grandpa on this? I'll just tell you this. And again, this is so personal, but you know, maybe it'll help answer. My grandfather was intelligence during World War II. My grandfather's the smartest, most decent man I ever met in my life. I never knew my dad. He died when I was 2 months old. So my grandfather, my mom's dad, was everything to me. Everything. He was so dignified in every way, and he was so funny and so smart. But he was in intelligence during World War II. And his job was to train Marines what Japanese culture was like. So he monitored Japan all the time. He's stateside, so he's not in harm's way. But he's stateside, he monitors what's going on, and then basically he trains Army and Marines, anyone who's gonna infiltrate the Japanese islands, what the culture's like, what to expect. So he knew what he was doing. He's not some guy who's just, you know, he's high up. And so there he is, and on the day that we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, my mom's still alive, she's 80, she's fantastic, but
I mean, she's still got her hell. She's still as bright as, it's incredible. But, okay, so how old would she have been in 45? Right. What, I think she would have been eight, right? I think she was eight. So here she is, she's 8 years old, and my grandpa comes home. She's heard the news. We bombed, we have a city, we have a bomb that can blow up a city. How cool, to my 8-year-old mother. So she composed a dance. She spent the day making a dance so that when my grandfather came home to celebrate and to congratulate him, because she knew, not details, but she knew that he was involved in the Japanese part of the war, she made this dance for him, this very elaborate dance. You have to know my mom. I'm sure you're shocked, but we're not exactly a normal family. So she makes this dance, and my grandfather comes home, and this still gets to me. And my mom's never forgotten this, ever. How could she? She says, "Dad, I did this for you to celebrate American victory over these Japanese." And she does this dance for my grandfather. And my grandfather, basically pats her on the head in a nice, loving way and says, "Rita, that's beautiful. But you have to understand something. Almost everyone who died looked just like you." What do you say to that? That's incredible. I mean, we killed thousands of little kids. What do you do? So anyway, sorry, Scott. I mean, I hope that it's probably far more than you wanted. But this is the kind of thing that, when I read Machiavelli, man, you really had to go there. I'm sorry to be so personal, but it is, it's a hard thing. So, yes, Mary Kate.
What would you say about other high casualty bombings over the course of that war?
Dresden and,
Not even Dresden, because I know the Church of England announced that, but like the bombing of, say, Berlin or Tokyo, where they were obviously, they were bombing a government city, but it was a very high civilian death toll.
Yeah, it's so hard. I mean, in those cases where you've got such an intermixing of government and people and military structures, and especially with primitive bombs where you're dropping them from 3 miles up, and it's really hard. I mean, now, in a sense, warfare, ironically, can be far more humane because of technology. It's not. That's what's interesting. We're still hitting weddings. We're still hitting people's homes. But you think about this, if I launched a cruise missile or any accurate modern missile from right here, and I launched it at Yankee Stadium, I could get within inches of the pitcher's mound if I wanted to. That's incredible. It's ironic that the more sophisticated our weaponry can become, the more humane it can actually be. But it hasn't worked that way, and I don't have an answer, Mary Kate. I just don't. I wish I did. I don't have an answer. I think drone warfare, I think it's cowardly. It's weird. I mean, think about this. We are in the middle of three wars right now. How many of us are really affected by that? That's weird. If we're at war, we should all be involved or we should not be involved, in my opinion. This is a constitutional decision. Either the American people say, "We're gonna knock the crap out of you," or we don't do it. But the fact we can have guys sitting in bunkers in Nevada killing civilians abroad, and we don't even know at the moment. I just think that's weird. I'm very uncomfortable with that. I'm glad to save American lives, don't get me wrong, but I'm not sure it should come at the expense of some little kid somewhere. It bothers me a lot. So, again, guys, please know, you have to make your own decisions about this. And I'll end with this today. One of my best friends, man who actually buried one of my children, a man who was part of a baptism of another child, Father Bill Miss Campbell, who is, I think, one of the greatest men alive, who teaches at Notre Dame. He's a historian there. He thinks I'm just completely wrong on all of this. He thinks the decision to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was the best thing that could have happened to end the war. He's a priest, and he's a serious priest, and he's brilliant, and he's one of the most godly men I've ever met in my life. He disagrees with me 100%. So I don't want you to think, this is Not that you would take my view as absolute. I just want you to understand this is a serious debate. So, and I'm definitely on one weird side. So, okay, good. Thanks, everybody. Sorry, too moralistic today. But, you know, I think about this. There's a lot to give thanks for, right? A lot. Okay, so your tests that I'm going to hand back now. So I apologize that I don't have everybody's. Those of you, John, feel free to take off. Anybody who needs to go, since I don't have your test, but Reagan, Abby, thank you. Sheridan, Alexander, I met a good friend of your father's. I was at a conference this weekend. Father Michael Butler, this fantastic guy, hilarious. So Jordan.
I'm busy from 4 to 6 today.
What's
it? 4 to 6.
Did
I just get
tomorrow? Oh, you're emailing.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine, John. Thanks. Joey? Lauren? This class. Nate? I'm sorry I didn't get everybody's. I apologize for that.
Okay, Mary.
Scott.
I'm not. I want to know.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Will you be here tomorrow where I can pick up my exam, or should I just go ahead and do
it? Email me first. Yes. Yes, I should. I should. I think I have a lunch appointment tomorrow. I got to double check my calendar.
Okay, I agree.
But yeah, do definitely email me, Veronica. I can also, you know, I can scan your thing too, if you want to see comments or anything. So yeah, but email me and request that, right? So I remember.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.